Okay, welcome into another episode of That's So Cincinnati. Here with my partner in crime, Sherry Coolidge. Sherry.
Hi, Jason. How are you?
Back in the studio this week after our time at Braxton. Want to thanks to the Braxton folks again for having us out, and thanks to you guys for listening and rolling with a little something different. We just tried a little something different, and but we're going to get back to our usual format this week. Special guest today is Ryan Messer, a mover and shaker in Cincinnati, and also the vice president of the Cincinnati Public Schools Board of Education. Looking forward to chatting with him.
Yeah, he think he's brought a lot to talk about. And I mean, and also I think he knows about your favorite subject.
We'll talk to him about the streetcar, as he's one of the people who really helped to save the streetcar back in 2013. And but is not really your typical streetcar supporter. Someone who is really a person who's rolled up their sleeves behind the scenes and legitimately fought to help save the project, but has handled things in a very graceful and professional way. And so I'm really excited about talking to him. I always enjoy talking to Ryan, and I know you do too, Sherry. So, but first, let's talk about something that seems like it may be becoming so Cincinnati, and that is the conundrum, maybe, shall we say, over the Millennium Hotel and a new convention hotel here in downtown Cincinnati. What in the heck is going on?
I mean, I'm going to let you tell people what's going on, thanks to your Sunday column. But honestly, this is an issue at least a decade in the making, if not longer. That hotel is not doing its job to bring the big conventions here. It's our largest convention hotel, and it's not in good condition. The Inquirer has been writing about this for years. Mm-hmm. And, you know, word's gotten around. It's not just the Yelp reviews, although I encourage people, if you want to know about the Millennium, to read the Yelp reviews. It's quite the rabbit hole. But, I mean, word's gotten around. Like, we don't have one single space with the 800,000 rooms for these big conventions. If you come to Cincinnati for a convention, you spread out all over, and we have some amazing boutique hotels now. That has been like a hallmark of the past couple years. Mm-hmm. But it is not that single space where everyone can be together, and maybe they have meetings on the ground floor. And so, some news that broke last week.
So, yeah. Local developer Rob Smijunas, the owner and founder of Vandercar Holdings, which you listener out there may are familiar with Vandercar Holdings and this developer by the Oakley Station development and the Center of Cincinnati development, both right next door to each other up in that area in Oakley around Crossroads and Target and New Kroger, all that stuff. He has struck a deal with the stubborn owner of the parent company of the Millennium Hotel, who is a Singaporean billionaire.
I mean, that was such shocking news. I mean, former Mayor Mark Mallory tried, John Cranley has tried. These people have been trying for years to have a conversation about this. And then this bombshell that there's a deal in the works.
Yep, and going down the line, business leaders, convention leaders, other developers have tried and not gotten anywhere with the Millennium owners. But Rob Smijunas struck up a relationship with the chairman of the Millennium Hotel back in, really went directly to him in mid-March, and it led to, in principle, a $36 million deal. However, and so he had Smijunas has a unique to Cincinnati anyway, idea of how to fund this. Again, here's a private developer who went out and did his own deal with this company that has been very reluctant and has battled with other Cincinnati leaders through the years, as Sherry mentioned.
And I think that's what we want here. That's what we've been talking about.
Yep.
The idea of like giving all these tax incentives that we're supposed to be making our city, you know, getting it to the point where we're so people want to be here and do these private deals without that kind of thing happening. And so this is starting in a very, you know, developer way and not starting with City Hall.
But this deal came at a time when 3CDC and the Port Authority and the city and the county had already, and I believe it was in the Convention and Visitors Bureau came together, and Sherry, you and I were at that press conference back in, I believe it was April or May, where they all came together and announced that they were going to build a new convention hotel at 5th and Plum, which is just south. Right now, it's basically a vacant lot just south of the convention center. There's been ideas that the hotel would go on that site, and where the current Millennium site is where they could potentially expand the convention center to someday across Elm Street. And so now you've basically got sort of the, you know, the city, county, and 3CDC, which is the city's preferred developer on so many projects, the Port Authority, which is funded by the city and the county. You have all those folks over here, and then you got the private developer and Rob Smijunas over on the other side. And now there's a lot of pushback on Smijunas's deal. And there, I will say, the devil's in the details. He's not taking on a lot of risk here. It's he's asking for this little-known board called the Convention Facilities Authority, which is half its members are appointed by the county, half are appointed by the city, to basically issue the bonds and then own this hotel. It's really a pass-through board. And so Smijunas stands to really not take on a lot of risk. And so the question right now being raised by some of those folks I just listed, city, county, CFA folks, are what if something goes wrong with this project in the middle of it? If who's on the hook for paying the bonds? Revenue bonds. So what if we hit a recession and they have to stop this project right in the middle of it? We get a half-built hotel and the bond owners take over ownership of this site. Then what happens? Is it worse than what we have right now? And so there's a lot of questions coming on that side. I also believe, and from my several conversations, is that you got a lot of egos involved here.
Say, what was the headline of your column? I mean, really,
The headline was something like Cincinnati's new convention hotel, egos, outsiders, and politics. Smijunas, though he's been here for several years, married into a Cincinnati, very prominent Cincinnati family, done a lot of Cincinnati development. Is still, he grew up in New Hampshire and is still sort of viewed as an outsider. And he's not in that, you know, that city, county, 4th Street crowd. And so I think there are some, I think there are some hurt feelings going on right now. And certainly some clash of egos between developers. And so you have those things going on, but that's natural. You're going to have those kinds of things happen when there's politicians and developers and you know, business folks involved. You have to work through those things. On the flip side, Smijunas in some ways holds all the cards because he's the only one who has been able to get the Millennium Hotel to sell. So if the Millennium Hotel and if Smijunas's deal gets foiled, the Millennium Hotel could then still pull out of this. It's not a completed deal yet. And then that's where it gets a little bit iffy because the Millennium Hotel is run down. It continues to have fewer and fewer guests. And this company has shown it's willing to sit on empty properties. There is currently right now in the heart of downtown St. Louis, the old Millennium Hotel. It's a circular tower that has been sitting empty since 2014.
Which is not something we want. And, you know, I had a lot of people over the weekend ask me, why should I care about the convention center? I don't go to conventions. But we are talking about a quadrant of downtown, and this is super important for the vibrancy of our downtown. I mean, the idea is that you book the convention hotel during the week with these big conventions, and you have to bring, I think the number is 10,000, but don't hold me to numbers, but you have to bring in so many people to keep our restaurants vibrant. And it just can't be the weekend crowd going to all of, you know, our new restaurants, drawing all these attention. Like, we need the people that come to these conventions, you know, to be downtown, to shop, mm-hmm. go to restaurants, and you know, and bring their money here. You want them to go to the casino. Casino taxes go straight back to the city and county, you know, to their operation budgets. And so these people are important to our city. And I've also heard a lot of comparisons. If you go to this part of the downtown right now, it's pretty dead. The Enquirer is kind of like at the bottom of it, and we got to walk some ways to get places. We can go south now to the banks, but you're going north, and there's not a lot of things, and you don't want the conventioners to see that. Like, that's not what happens when you go to Columbus. If you walk outside their convention center, it's just this vibrant restaurant. It's like, wow, I'm in downtown Columbus. And then they go back to their cities and say, wow, I was just in this great city, this, that, and the other. And so that is why this matters to the city. These people bring their money, and we want, you know, all parts of our downtown to be vibrant. And if this happens, I mean, to me, I was thinking about the idea of what's happening downtown right now. You know, we're seeing this new hotel over by Lytle Park on one corner. The banks, you know, as much as, you know, consternation as there's been, there's a music venue to the south. We have the soccer stadium over by the West End, in the West End. And we're really, these corners are really catching on fire. And I think, I mean, the idea of keeping that momentum going is so important.
Absolutely.
And that's why this matters.
We're getting our butts kicked right now in the convention business. A lot of it has to do with the fact that we have the Millennium Hotel and all these other peer cities have Cleveland, Columbus, Louisville, Indianapolis, Nashville. All these cities have new or newer convention, large with massive meeting spaces. And all these conventions, I'm told there's a lot of conventions that would like to come here because they like our location, they like our airport, they like our layout of our downtown, but they don't like what our hotel situation is. And you can't have big conventions without great hotels and hotels with ample space. And so the moral of the story is Cincinnati has to get this right, or we're going to continue to fall behind in this really important economic driving area.
No, I agree with that. So I think there's going to be a lot more to come. This news is very fresh, which is, of course, why we want to talk about it on That So Cincinnati podcast. But there's a lot coming here.
Well, let's stay tuned on that. I'm doing a lot of reporting on that. And
Randy Tucker, too.
Randy Tucker,
and Scott Boardman,
reporter.
You know, the county reporter. So I think the commissioners, I'm sure, are going to be weighing in on this pretty soon.
Yes, the commissioners are very much involved in this, especially the commission president, Denise Driehaus, Mayor John Cranley, the county administrator, Jeff Aluto. So there's a lot of key players involved here. And stay tuned on that. Again, we're going to be all over this, and we're continuing to be all over it. So let's shift gears.
You know what? Before Ryan comes in, let's give a shout out to our colleague Max Longberg. You know, you recognize his byline. He's been, you know, working at night covering a lot of breaking news, and it's not been quiet, everyone, as you know. And so he's kind of been all over since he got to the Enquirer. But the Enquirer is placing a renewed attention on education. And Max, very good reporter. I'm not saying that because we're going to sit by him, but, you know, that probably help. And so he's going to take over that role. And, you know, I encourage people to reach out to him with those kind of stories as we get back into that. And so, you know, I've already connected him with Ryan, and that's just a start. So I think there's going to be a lot of stories with the colleges and everything.
Absolutely. He'll be covering what? Preschool all the way through higher education.
Well, he has a big job. We won't pretend otherwise. But it's great that we have him, you know, on this beat.
Absolutely. So be checking that out on Cincinnati.com for our education reporting. Max Lomberg will be all over it. Let's shift gears. Speaking of schools, let's shift gears to Ryan Messer from the Cincinnati Public Schools Board, and bring in Ryan. All right, welcome into our guest segment here on the TSC podcast. He is the vice president, I almost said vice chairman, the vice president of the Cincinnati Public Schools Board, the fastest growing district in Ohio. Welcome to the hot seat, Ryan Messer. Good to see you.
Good to see you. Thank you.
Hi, Ryan.
Hello.
I don't even know where to start. You do so many things in this town, and when I think of you, I think a mover and shaker. And
you're involved in so many things in politics and community stuff, and you know, so we'll get to that, but just tell us a little bit about you and let's start with this. You were once the president of the Over the Rhine Community Council.
I was.
Correct?
Proudly.
And I think a lot of people probably identify, at least general public would identify you as one of the key people who helped save the streetcar. And that was where I first got to know you through that.
Ryan brought all the balloons from like the famous picture outside City Hall with all those balloons.
The green balloons.
That's right.
Let's go to that. Was that really your first kind of big project in Cincinnati, or a big community project?
Yeah, I think it's the project that expanded out beyond the neighborhood that I was in. You know, I first came to Cincinnati in 2001. I grew up in the very far west suburbs of Cincinnati in a little town called Rising Sun, Indiana. So we claim Cincinnati as our mega center where we would make the trip a couple of times a year for clothes and that type of thing. but when I moved back to Cincinnati after college and Johnson & Johnson moved me to Cincinnati in 01, got a chance to come home, be close to my parents and the farm I grew up on, which is about an hour away. I selected the place where just about anybody would select, which is Westwood, to live. Yeah. And I say that because when people move to Cincinnati, you know, it used to be people didn't move originally to Westwood. Now they would, thanks to some incredible work being done there. But I moved to Westwood and got involved there in the community council and chaired a home tour there and got involved in neighborhood type activities and, you know, working back in those days on the issues that were important to Westwood. But then Johnson & Johnson moved me for a year to New York City. And I got to live right in Manhattan at 37th and 9th, which is, if you squint your eyes, you think you're in Cincinnati because it's the piece of New York that looks just like it did in the late 1800s with the Italianate three- or four-story buildings that look like OTR. So when I came back after that year, I decided I was going to live downtown, and it was about that time that there was a sign up on this little building that was Lava-matic, and Jean Robert was going to do a restaurant, and I thought, okay, I'm going to find a house here. So that's how I found Over the Rhine the first time when I came back to Cincinnati, and then ultimately bought a house there and renovated that, which people thought we were nuts, and it happened to be on that parking lot. It's not so good things happened in that parking lot where our house sat became Washington Park.
And, I mean, I love that because you were really on the ground floor of Over the Rhine redevelopment. You were there before it was kind of cool to be there.
Yeah. When things, you know, where lots of people who had been there for generations were mixing in with people like me who had chosen to move there relatively recently compared to them. Mm-hmm. And then frankly, lots of other people from all sorts of random places, Karen and Brad Hughes, who now started Artichoke at Finley Market, you know, they were coming right down the street from us. The Mocks had moved in not too far from us, and it really started to create a community that, you know, I think was an important part of Over the Rhine becoming a neighborhood of the future, which is connecting the people that live there mm-hmm. into the process. And that's how I originally got involved with the community council, et cetera.
What year were you, did you start getting involved with that community council?
I feel like, you know, my memories get a little foggy after all these kids and everything, but I feel like that was about 2009, 2010 that I got really involved in the leadership role of the community council. Actually, no, I take that back. Yeah, probably about that. Maybe 2008, 2009.
Oh, so you're married now, though, and you have four children.
That's right.
And you live in North Avondale, right?
Yeah.
I wrote about your house when you were redoing it.
Yeah, we...
Marion Hall. It's the kind of house that has a name, which is why you write about it.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think that one thing that is consistent, I've never lived in a home in Cincinnati that wasn't at least 100 years old.
That is something you can do in Cincinnati.
Yeah.
And Marion Hall used to be... a dormitory?
It was a dorm.
Because you're right next door to the Xavier campus.
That's right.
And it was a dormitory for Xavier for a long time.
There were three families that called our house home from 1897 up till about 1950. And the third family, when she lost her husband, married a man that had built a home in Indian Hill, and that became the next set of suburbs. So she donated the home to Xavier. So then it housed, you know, for 50 years, 50, 60 guys a year in the house. And so...
all who've come by to visit, right?
Many. We actually just hosted last fall the class of 1969.
Do you do that? Are you doing that every year?
Well, if they ask, we're happy to. But it was great to see this group of like 15, 20 men, and most of them had their wives with them, who all lived in this house together and had these great stories. It was great to just sit back and listen and to see.
Oh,
I mean, there were tears and there were jokes and maybe some things we didn't want to hear. Like the one guy said, oh, whose room is that? I could tell you some stories about the guy that lived there. You wouldn't believe some of the stuff. And I said, that's my daughter Lillian's room. Don't say another word. Yeah. So that was
so
that
I was going to say, so all of that, what we're talking about now is just a glimmer in your eye, because I don't want to jump ahead.
Right.
So you're living in Over the Rhine. You get involved with the community council.
Yes.
You become the president of it, because that's how you roll, right? And, I mean, how did the streetcar kind of come on your radar at that point?
Well, you know, I wasn't, frankly, involved in the streetcar campaigns that had taken place. There were, you know, the various issues. And I remember, like, there were different people who had that as, like, a full-time job. They were promoting that ballot measure and outworking. That was just not even on my radar. Yes, I was going to vote for it because I believe transportation, because I've had the fortune of getting to travel internationally. I did a backpacking trip right after college, before I started with Johnson & Johnson, and just survived by transit. I didn't have a car. I took trains from city to city and then within the cities. And, you know, I don't think it's a stretch to realize that there are only so many lanes that you can put on the highways coming through Cincinnati. Right now, I mean, we're going to have 20. If we go at this rate, we'll have 20 lane wide highways. So there will be a time. And so while I wasn't an active driver in it, pardon the pun, I was a supporter of us beginning the conversation to have transit. And the streetcar I viewed as the nucleus of a much broader transit network that, yes, you might have high speed between Cleveland to Columbus to Dayton and or Cincinnati or any configuration thereof. But once you got to the city—
That was being very seriously talked about at that time.
That's
and
right.
The first mention of the streetcar in the Cincinnati Inquirer was in 2011. Janelle mentioned it in relation to Music Hall, and she said people are quietly talking behind the scenes about a streetcar. It's like the very first mention of the streetcar is in the paper.
Yeah.
And now there's been, I don't know, roughly, Jason, I don't know, what do you think?
I don't know.
2,000 articles, 10,000 articles since then.
Well, way
then
too many.
To tie me personally to it, so I saw this neighborhood where there were lots of vacant buildings. I fell in love with the building, or we fell in love with the building, that had been vacant for 20 plus years on this big parking lot, admittedly, but even still, there was this beautiful building that I loved to go to. I've been going to the Cincinnati Opera since I was probably 22. Has a special place in my heart, and to be able to live that close to that. And, you know, I love taking an old building and recreating that. I did that as my first house at 21 in Indianapolis, right after college. This was a win-win. When I went to banks, I went to five different banks with a big presentation. I had people that connected me with people in the infancy of 3CDC to say, here's kind of what they were planning to do in the neighborhood. So I was trying to make the case that I get it. There's no comps. But if you lend me this money and we do this together, we can help build our city. Well, one by one, they'd say, great. You've got excellent credit. Like your plans. We can lend you $250,000, okay? Well, you can't do a home in Over the Rhine with $250,000 when you have to spend $50,000 to shore up the foundation. Then you have to gut the whole place because the roof collapsed, and now you have to hang new floor joists and everything else. Now put a new roof on it. You're already $150,000 in, and you've just gotten it to be able to start construction.
To the bones.
Yeah. So I kind of went on very bad— financial, you know, what would go against financial logic to borrow against my 401k so that I could do that first property. Because what I knew is there were tracks. We had voted not once, not twice, but three times on the streetcar, right? And all three times it said we were going forward. So I put the money in, knowing that those tracks were starting right down the two blocks from where that house was, that it gave me like, yes, we could have there could be one more shooting or one more something. Hmm. I could lose everything that I'd worked up until that point for 12 years at Johnson & Johnson to save for. I could lose it all. But because those tracks had started, to me, it was a good, sound financial investment, because all the research I did was that every city that built a streetcar, revitalization and economic development followed. So to me, it was sound business logic that you can look at a pattern, not a single city where it was a failure, not one, all the cities that went before us. So I saw that as a good investment. So when there was a threat of it being canceled, I was like, no, 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 no. Because by then it wasn't just me. It was people like Jean-Francois, who opened Taste of Belgium, and the owners of The Anchor and owners of Zula, and then all the other residents. We'd all put our money in, frankly, above what the value was for that. Now, if that had gone away, could that have put everybody at absolute financial risk? Absolutely. And so to me, it was, you had a lot of people that made a decision based on three ballot measures that said we were going forward. And then the second part was, everything that I learned was, if the federal government gives you money and you start to use it, they want you to finish the project. And if you don't, you're going to owe it back to them. So when, you know, the famous words, the conversation was over, was said, it was like, okay, well, let's hold that for a second. Let's make sure that we're not going to lose more money to cancel it than it would be to go forward, and understand that the value of it could prepare us for future growth in transit, not just with the 3-point whatever mile connector loop that is today. I think
we should say, for people who don't know, although I feel like most of our listeners do know, but still, you know, there was trouble with the project. It was supposed to go up to Clifton. The governor at the time, John Kasich, said, we're not going to do that, took the money away. And then the conversation became, do we just keep it in the downtown over the Rhine loop since it's changed? Should we do that? And then secondly, Mayor Mark Mallory, big champion of the project, term limited it out. We get a new mayor, John Cranley, and he didn't see the value of this shortened route. But, and so we were at a turning point or a crossroads.
And so in 2013, John Cranley campaigns on killing the streetcar. And I want our listeners to understand, I know a lot of people are in tune to this, but I think this really speaks to Ryan and our guest today, Ryan Messer, is, so you rally hundreds and hundreds of people. And this is, I remember a meeting where it was overflow at the Mercantile Library, and somehow you guys worked it out to have the overflow of the crowd go on the Fountain Square, and they simulcast the meeting, which you and several others spoke at, on the big screen at Fountain Square.
And that's a great story in and of itself.
And that was, I mean, that was the time, and I was still pretty early in my time here at the Enquirer. I've been here 7.5 years, and that was, I want to say, was that fall of 2013? It was before the election.
No, that was right after the election.
It was right, okay.
Because the election was on a Tuesday. I sent out a message that I said, okay, anybody want to talk about this? Let's have a meeting on Saturday at our house. Well, a few hundred people show up. And then we had a press conference. And then we said, let's have a town hall.
Yep.
And the Facebook invite just kept blowing up. And then, the fire marshal, I guess, whoever contacted the Mercantile, who contacted me, said, they're going to shut the doors. So I thought, what could I do to get those, that Jumbotron? So I called 3CDC, who managed it.
Yeah, right.
Gave him my personal credit card to rent that. And then I had a recent college grad who hooked up some little camera to their laptop that connected me to Fountain Square. You know, it's just kind of a cool way that that all worked out.
And that was like second week of November of 2013. And at that point, I haven't seen much like that in Cincinnati since. I mean, there was a real movement around that, and there was real tangible energy that you were, and you were Orcus. I mean, you had gotten all these people there, and you know, you could tell like this, you know, excuse my, but this thing is moving down the tracks and it's not stopping. And mm-hmm. then you guys take it and convince, help basically convince the council and the Hale Foundation and others to essentially save the streetcar.
Yeah. And, you know, it was lots of dialogue, and it was my first time in City Hall.
I remember you telling me that, yeah.
You know, those first hearings and the first time speaking to a council, and the first time I met Charlie Lucan's father, I remember that. That was memorable. And, you know, I think it gave people something that they could believe in and connect to, because we did call it Believe in Cincinnati, because it wasn't just about the streetcar. It was really about what future we thought Cincinnati could live into.
Well, the one thing that really impressed me about your, you know, you rallied so many people, your leadership, and just how you, we know it's such a lightning rod project, and there are so many folks on both sides who have a hard time kind of avoiding some pretty pointed rhetoric. But you have always been someone who has been able to really calmly kind of keep the rhetoric and really to try to keep things moving forward and try to make sure things are collaborative around it. I know there's been some tough conversations behind the scenes on that. I've always been impressed by that. And what I want to ask you about is, do you feel like that experience really sets you on a path to being in elected office now as the vice president of the school board?
I think so. Because I think it's one thing to be an activist and a proponent of the neighborhood you live in. That's the easy part.
Yeah.
And then it gets a little bit more complex when you're trying to balance the needs of a much broader audience. And, you know, one of the takeaways was we had one of the fastest signature drives, I think, in the history. And you remember the last minute when those signatures were delivered, I was actually leaving the country and I was sitting at JFK Airport. And I remember texting, like, where are the signatures? Take the signatures in. And when they delivered those, I think there were a lot of, like, wow, they delivered thousands. What was it? It was a crazy.
How many was it?
What was required? I think it was 20,000?
It's a big number like that, though, because it's based on the last vote.
And so,
oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's always a percentage of the.
And I remember we had a little office over on Court Street, and everybody – and you'd have little ladies coming in that remember riding the streetcar to the zoo when they were little girls. And you had – it was the most diverse group of people you can imagine that were out collecting these signatures. And it was all like just a constant flow. And, you know, when we did a retrospective of those signatures, there were people that represented every single one of the Cincinnati neighborhoods. So it wasn't really like – and it was only like 18% of the total number of people who signed the signature drive actually lived in close proximity to the loop in the neighborhoods of downtown and over the Rhine.
Nice.
So – you know, I thought that was a big deal.
The city speaks.
So 82% of the people who supported it out of those thousands of people that signed didn't live in the two neighborhoods. And now I'm one of those people. I don't live in one of the neighborhoods. Do I think it's a good idea? Yeah. You know, my good friend Bill Cunningham, a couple weeks ago, I guess, has historically given like comments like, where's Ryan Messer? Now the streetcar is not, you know, this.
He says that on occasion.
He's right here on the hot seat.
And so I called him. And I said, hey, Bill, I was told somebody sent me a text that you called me out. And he said, oh, well, you want to come on the show this afternoon? And we had a great conversation. He said, well, where are you? And I said, well, the problem is that was to determine whether or not we were going to go forward. I don't work for the city.
Right.
I work for Johnson & Johnson. Now, if you've got a consulting agreement that you want to pay me, but we are paying people every day with my tax dollars to do the projects that this city has voted for. So that was kind of the conversation I had with him. It is now an infrastructure project for the city of Cincinnati. And, you know, I do think City Hall has to, whether you support it or not, that's not your choice. That's not an option at this point. The voters, the taxpayers, it's going forward. Everybody should wake up and make sure that it's a success in any way that they can.
What do you want to see happen to it in the future? If you could magically decide, like, what's next for it?
Yeah, I think that the movement to explore the opportunities to take it to Clifton, I don't know anyone, even the most adamant people in opposition to the streetcar with it here. They said, well, then it should at least go up to the Pill Hill, connect to the university, et cetera, which I absolutely agree with. But, you know, and I think hopefully John Cranley and I have buried the hatchet on that particular issue. It's many years ago now. But at the same time, there are a lot of people that elected him that, you know, it wouldn't be good for him to say, okay, now I'm supporting it. Mm-hmm. So it's been a tough spot for him, I think, because he's got constituency, et cetera. And it is a hot potato. So I think it's going to be an interesting question for the next mayor. What is the next step? And what I would do is say, let's figure out a way uptown and approach it a little differently. Let's figure out the funding first. And let's figure out how we create an economic story that makes sense before we do the work, which also includes applying for those Tiger grants that all the other cities are applying for and getting, where they're doing their extensions that are paid for completely by the federal government. And yeah, it might take some operating costs, but people made a big deal about the operating costs in this last budget. It was less than the amount of copy paper that they spend in a year. Literally. So you can throw those numbers out, but when you put it in comparison, it's a drop in the bucket of the overall spend. And so, you know, I think that the next mayor hopefully will look at that. And then I think hopefully we have leadership in Columbus and in Washington that understands road transportation cannot be our sole focus. And I think there's a lot of historical reasons why that is, power of the car companies, et cetera.
You bring up a good point about talking about the future and what could be in store for the project. And as you referenced, there's an election, city election coming up in 2021 where the city will get a new mayor. And there's six council members termed out, so you'll get pretty much an entire new council as well. Do you know if any conversations or active conversations are going on right now about an expansion?
I know of none.
Okay.
Although I'm a little out of the loop these days, as education has become, you know, my primary focus as I think about my non-work brain.
Yeah.
And we're starting to hear and be more thoughtful, I think, as a community about the idea of what kind of budget the schools have and that the schools are in every neighborhood and that it's just as big a deal as city council it's typically like all of the focus is on city council, but we have seen some shift to the schools. And of course the commission's, you know, they're in the hot seat for a lot of these like big change projects too. And so
you oversee a $1.1 billion budget?
Yeah. I think people, you know, have no idea that that's the dollars that it takes to run Cincinnati Public Schools. But they also don't know that we have over 36,000 kids.
Yeah.
And as you said earlier, we are the fastest growing school district in the state of Ohio. And I think there's that's a great measure to show the great things that are happening at Cincinnati Public Schools.
Why the growing? What's behind that?
Well, you know, I think as you think about public schools, you know, I can't think, there's just no other choice for me. I grew up in public schools. You only had one choice in Rising Sun, Indiana, one school, the public school. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I believe that we have to make sure our public schools are high performing because we've got to utilize those as a tool to mitigate some of the challenges that are faced in our society, poverty, et cetera. And, you know, I think here in Cincinnati, you know, we are experiencing the fruits of some of the labors of our current superintendent when she was deputy superintendent and dove headfirst into ensuring that our neighborhood schools had a magnet-like focus, and it was a phased-in approach. And I don't know that a lot of people know about that. It was kind of happening behind the scenes. And each year, more and more were added to that. And this year, the final nine are added to what's called Vision 2020. And if you think about these schools that kind of started out as just run-of-the-mill neighborhood school, and now like Westwood is the entrepreneur school. That's mm-hmm. their focus. It's amazing to see these children. They're producing products that are available on Etsy. They talk about cost of goods sold. And as a sales and marketing guy, I'm like, wow, these are third graders or fifth graders. So I think that the focus on our neighborhood schools, but then making sure that we're continuing to push the envelope on options that are available to our community in a variety of neighborhoods and on different parts of town. Many of us, I think, would say CPS had a big opportunity to expand and provide more options and more quality seats in the West Side. And as a former resident there, I have a soft place in my heart, which was why I thought it was exciting for that new Gamble High School at the old Mercy campus. In addition to taking the old Gamble High School and turning that into a Montessori elementary school, which, by the way, is almost filled, in addition to the other options that we have there, it really started to now balance our portfolio of the seats. And, you know, I think kind of across the board, people are now trusting CPS to be that school of choice for their families.
From your perch on the board, what is one thing that you absolutely love that CPS is doing right now? And what's one thing that you really want to see changed?
You know, I'm relatively new. This is, I've kind of halfway through my term now. This is
and you were elected, first elected in the fall, in November of 2017.
Yeah.
So first term, number one vote getter.
First term, number one vote getter.
That was fun. you know, I think the thing that I'm most proud of is I feel that, the district, the board is more in touch with our communities than ever before. You know, we are present. We've had multiple input sessions on just about everything that we've done up into and including the brand new strategic plan that we've just rolled out. So I think our community engagement is high. Could we do better? Absolutely. But it's pretty high, I think. Just people hear about CPS. They know what's going on.
Yeah.
So I think that's good. We still have to continue to focus on our academic achievement. If you look across the district, we're making gains. But, you know, we don't want to just say, oh, well, we look good compared to the other urban districts. We want to say we look good compared to any school option in Cincinnati, private, parochial, or public. And so we have to keep the academic rigor up. But let's be very clear. The students that walk into the door of our school looks very different than the average student that walks into a parochial or private school, generally speaking. Our children, many are in poverty. Many don't have the traditional family structure. Many don't have access to tutors and all the outside things that maybe middle class or upper middle class would be able to afford for their children. So it takes more money to get to the same result. But I think if you are able to look inside CPS, that's really where the magic. I was sitting at our board meeting this past week, and they were talking about these imaginative things that are happening. And I just thought, you know, I'm not an education wonky. I'm on the board because I'm a parent of current and future CPS students, and I care about it. I also know the value of education to the future of our city. But to hear kind of all these additional programs they're putting in place to level the playing field for the average CPS student is amazing. And so, you know, I think we're doing many of the right things. And with this final iteration of Vision 2020 and the extra focus on neighborhood schools, it's going to allow that focus on the academic achievement to start to see even more gains than we are today. But the most, the upcoming scorecard, we're very excited about those results that I can't talk about today.
Oh, do you already know them?
We've got a hint that we're moving in the
here.
Right
we're
direction.
We're all about news here on the TSC.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's information that I don't own that success. That's truly our amazing superintendent, Laura Mitchell. So I'll let you know, her start to share those information when that's available.
There's a huge thing coming up here with the tax abatement, and it's incredibly confusing and hard to understand. Can you just sort of give the synopsis of what's coming up here around the tax and it's tax abatements, right?
Yeah.
What's happening and what's at stake, and yeah.
So this is fascinating. I'm a learner. I love to just dig in and kind of understand issues. So this one's been a fun one for me because, you know, I heard a lot of the groundswell of these abatements are horrible. We've got to stop these abatements. And so, then I got on the board and I became chair of the finance committee and started to understand, that, you know, it's a much more complicated web of, topics that are kind of in that discussion. There's the residential tax abatement, which people were shocked when I shared at a board meeting that we as a school board have nothing to do with. So if the city wants to have a citywide abatement program where you get 10 years tax abated or 15 for a lead, city can do that without input to us or from us.
Even though it takes money out of
money from us. But that the residential is something that we have nothing to do with. So people disagreed, and then finally they were like, oh, I guess the school board has nothing to do with that. So that's a city council issue. Right. I think that was the fuel behind much of the agitation that people were feeling as it related to these abatements. If you're building a $2 million home overlooking the river in Hyde Park, and you get a 15-year tax abatement because you decided to make it lead,
yep,
you probably could afford to pay your taxes more than somebody you know, in one of our other 52 neighborhoods. So so that was a key piece to kind of peel off, even though I still think we have more work to make sure people understand these are two different things. Well, then I think because there was such confusion and specific focus on that particular part, people lumped all of it together. And I think the piece where the school board actually has a say is in approving how the city goes about developer agreements that drive development in our city.
Commercial development.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. And that's a very different approach. And, you know, often those agreements could work out very well for the schools. And so what we've tried to do is just say, here's what we want. We want to hold the schools harmless because if money doesn't come in from that side, it gets made up from the people on the residential, you know, who are paying their taxes. Mm-hmm. So we owe it to them. You know, I think there's some confusion about what's a fixed sum levy. Well, fixed sum levy is we're approving X number of millions of dollars. So your taxes are raised or lowered to match that. And, you know, I think that, you know, if you perform on the commercial side, it's going to raise what you need to do on the residential side. So what we did is try to establish, hold our district harmless as it relates to the developer agreements.
Because that agreement is expiring at the end of
this year, 2019.
It was
a 20-year agreement that was signed in 1999. And so, you know, I think there was a kind of a pulse out in the community that the school board wanted absolutely zero developer agreements. And I think that's completely false. What we want to do is make sure that was done in a fair and equitable way that was comparable to what other cities were doing. And when we did the benchmarking, which we had done for other cities around Ohio and then some other similar cities, we got great information. None of them said, we don't do any agreements and drive development. But what they did do is say, here's how we did it. There may be a development agreement. And then they did workforce development training for some of our high school students in specific fields.
That's
or
good.
They did mentoring. And so it becomes kind of a win-win while making sure that we hold the district harmless and drive development in our city and in our region that brings more families or provides jobs to families who need that, et cetera.
So the school board has some say in what they're going, what they'll allow to be forgiven under the law. But the city likes to be able to, when they want to, give a whole lot more. And I think that's kind of the sticking point. Like they want to do things how things have always been done. like just like the past 20 years, which is basically free reign over these without telling the school board what they're going to do. And the school board seems to want to have a say now. Is that right?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's just a responsibility to taxpayers and the children, and taxpayers meaning individual residents, et cetera, that these have to be done in the context of the impact it will have to taxpayers who have to pay property taxes and to the children who are impacted by the quality of our schools, et cetera. And, you know, I frankly think that kind of the resolution that we passed that laid the ground rules has really set up the negotiations between our team at CPS, which is not the board, it's people from the administration, with people that the city has designated. And I actually think that we'll get to a good place. You know, it just, you know, it's a process that everyone has to go through, and
we'll
do that before the end of this year.
Part of the ground thing that was built upon was how Stargell Stadium was handled. That deal was, I think there was going to be like large tax abatements there, just like business had always been done. And we had new board members, including yourself, who said that isn't how it's going to be. And I think that was maybe the first one. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, I think that when I remember we began those conversations, I feel like it was like they were going to hold us harmless. And we were going to get like $750,000. Okay. Well, good start. So I guess you have to start somewhere in negotiations.
Which is more than, you know, the schools have been getting on the current, what is right on that current property.
Yeah. And I think, you know, let's be clear. We did very well by this agreement. And, yep, and, you know, some people were very frustrated with the school board as a whole because we allowed the stadium to go there. My opinion, and I think the opinion of a lot of the people on the board, it wasn't our decision to make that. We don't own how our city should be developed, but if we had an opportunity to get a brand new state-of-the-art stadium, and if you've been over there, it's
awesome.
They're practicing right now. This is a world-class stadium. So we got a new stadium and a $10 million check to our schools. That's good for taxpayers. Now, was it good for that neighborhood?
A $10 million check from FC Cincinnati,
that's right,
correct?
To build the stadium you want.
Yeah. So, we got a stadium and $10 million. So they gave us the upfront $10 million to build our stadium, and then we got the upfront $10 million for their taxes for the foreseeable future that they were able to build into their capital costs, et cetera. So if you look at that, you could say that's a $20 million gain for Cincinnati Public Schools. That's a good thing for taxpayers. So the neighborhood side of me says, but how is this for our city? And that was the answer that city council, I think, had to make.
Yeah.
And what happens, and making sure that residents are not forced from their homes, to make sure that diversity remains in that neighborhood, is the responsibility of city council. I absolutely believe that.
Schools deal, though, it was the first time that we heard the school board push back and say, no, our students are not going to get cheated.
That's right. And we also pushed the idea and supported the idea, and I went to many, many meetings about this agreement that they were going to make with the neighborhood. And, you know, I think that there have been some great successes. And, you know, I was at an event last night where a woman expressed some concerns that maybe things weren't where they needed to be. Well, I sent a note to some city council members and said, somebody should look into this, because part of the agreement was we weren't going to push neighborhoods, people from this neighborhood. We weren't going to impact or negatively impact the kind of the history of that neighborhood. And so, you know, I think that is a city issue that needs to be closely monitored.
Sherry, you got any other questions? Anything fun for Ryan before we sign off?
Wait, can I give a little plug for our levy coming up this fall?
Of course. Well, you can't say no to that.
Yeah.
No, we're just absolutely talking not about
children. We can't be like, no, you can't do that.
So one thing that you know, I've learned is how schools are funded. And, you know, a big part of that is our local levies. And, you know, I can say that even with this growth, our superintendent has an incredible business mind. And hopefully our board can have that same kind of accolade as well. We're really thinking through how to be leaner, more efficient, and produce higher quality. And lots of QI, quality improvement initiatives throughout the district, looking at how we're more efficient with transportation, et cetera. So you won't see an increase in taxes, which is a great thing, where this is happening maybe in other places. This is just a renewal of our existing levies that will be on this fall. And, you know, all the things that we just rolled out in our three-year comprehensive strategic plan that we rolled out to the community last Friday, that is going to all be funded with our current funds. And so that will be on the ballot this fall, and we certainly hope that people will continue to support Cincinnati Public Schools because we're driving enrollment, which is based on our increasing scores academically, and some high-quality options being offered throughout the city in a number of different schools for children.
If you live in Cincinnati, this fall, there's a lot of CPS stuff on the ballot. Four school board seats are up, mm-hmm. yours not being one of them.
Thank goodness.
And so that's going to be quite a race, and obviously the levy as well. So, Ryan, thanks. This is great stuff. Really appreciate you coming by, and thank you for the snacks as well. Our first guest to bring snacks. Even Rich Grader didn't bring us anything.
No,
he brought us this great tray of meat and cheese and crackers, and it was great.
The best part of it is Phil took it away from us so we don't eat on air.
Yeah.
So, Ryan, thanks again.
Producer. My pleasure.
Have a great rest of the summer. Thanks.
Thanks so much.
Oh, yeah. Thanks to Ryan for coming in and giving us his time. And Ryan, again, you can come back anytime bringing us a nice meat and cheese tray. So thank you. Let's shift gears, have a little fun, getting back to our final segment. We're getting ready to say something, Sherry.
No, this is the fun part.
Well, speaking of, did you do anything fun this past weekend?
We did our typical bike riding out of 50 West. We've talked about that before. But you know what? It was so hot this weekend. So we went at night, and it was amazing. But I did something that's even more that's so Cincinnati.
Dun, dun, dun.
You know, I'm a West Sider. We went to the Incline House and sat outside. And, you know, honestly, it is one of my favorite dining spots in the city. Because you have this view of the whole, you know, skyline from the West, and it's amazing up there. You know, that's a John Cranley, you know, we're going to put a restaurant up there before he became the mayor. And driving through there now is so different than it used to be. There's Veracruz, Somme, if you want something fancier. I mean, we're Prima Vista people, which has always been there, and please God, always will be. But, you know,
Block Coffee is up there, the theater.
So it's come a long way. It's fun to drive through it and see the changes that have happened.
Yeah. And I don't know if there's a better view from any restaurant, certainly, of downtown and the skyline of the city than the Incline Public House, right?
Definitely. And, you know, I mean, we didn't eat Geta, but you know what we did eat? Fried pickles. I love fried pickles.
Which reminds me, Tickle Pickle. We haven't mentioned Tickle Pickle for a while.
Oh, my God, we haven't.
We got to go there sometime.
Yeah, that was remiss of us. We have to, yes. All right, that done. That's like an after Labor Day. Let's do that. Put that on the calendar.
As usual, I did nothing fun over the weekend. I just hung out with my family, and that's what I do. So
that's actually a good thing. I love to see you with your two boys who look exactly like you.
Well, one of them.
And it was that kind of weekend though, because it was like back to school week for both of us, and everyone was pretty tired. It's like all they did is go to school, you know, for a couple hours for 3 days, and it was like he's exhausted, I'm exhausted. But yeah, we're back to normal now.
We had our back to school bash. Our little carnival in Wyoming, so we had that on Friday night. That was fun.
Kind of carnival with like a Ferris wheel and like
jumpy houses and little food booths and games.
Do you get in the jumpy houses? Take your shoes off?
No, the kids do.
Take your Crocs off?
No, they take their Crocs off.
Okay.
Anyway, let's get out of this.
All right, thanks. Fair enough.
Sherry, you won't be here next week.
I won't. I'm going on vacation, and I'm really going on vacation.
Yes, you are.
I'm going to miss you, but still.
We'll miss you, too. Have fun. Safe travels. We will have a guest host next week.
Oh, I'll be listening, obviously.
Absolutely.
It's a beach vacation. We're beach people. So I'll have plenty of time to... I might even go back and listen to all the old podcasts just to do it.
Sounds
no,
great.
No, I won't do that.
Anyway, thanks. Be sure to check out Cincinnati.com. We run a 99-cent deal right now on digital subscriptions. Folks, thanks so much for all the feedback you've given us. Got a little feedback on the live show, and I got to say, it didn't go over too well with some listeners. So we are – it's just something we tried, and we're getting back to – that was a one-off kind of thing. And we may go on the road every once in a while, but count on us to be here in the studio in our three segments of politics or current events, a guest, and then our fun segment in the end. So thanks again. Let us know your feedback, good, bad, indifferent, at scoolidge at inquirer.com and at Sharon Coolidge on Twitter. I am... email jwilliams at inquirer.com and at jwilliamscincy with a Y on Twitter. So look forward to hearing from everyone, and thanks again so much for listening.